Hey, optimists. For all you business and leadership junkies, this episode is going to be like catnip. I got my hands on an early copy of the new book, The Leadership Map by Ian Windle, and I reached out to him to join me as a guest on his podcast. He's such a gent, he kindly agreed, and I was in my element discussing several of the principles from his book with him, as we touched on purposefulness, failure, change, stoicism, and sportsmen, among numerous other things. Anyway, definitely worth 30 minutes of your time at 1.25 speed, so let's hop in. And please don't forget to like and subscribe to this podcast in your favourite podcast app. Thanks, guys. Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the Chief Executive Optimist podcast, delivering resilience recipes for leaders and high performers and helping you to preserve your sanity and humanity in this time of relentless change. I'm Gareth Hawkins, Scale Up Investor and Principal Consultant and Coach at Enterprise Insights in London. Today I'm joined by TimeServe CEO, Leadership Coach, TEDx Speaker, podcast presenter and now published author Ian Windle, whose new book, The Leadership Map, is comprised of 12 teenets grouped into three parts on vision, people and strategy. And it's told through the real world stories of companies and leaders that Ian has worked with personally. It contains many insightful tools and references and is designed to underpin transformative workshops that companies can take to put Ian's models into practice. So welcome, Ian.
Thank you very much, Gareth. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you with us. I've been an addict of the Gritty Leaders podcast that you co-host with Ben Wales since its inception, really. Found it really quite an uplifting listen and also one that has given me great food for thought. So I'm hoping we can cover a number of those nuggets in our chat today.
Great.
But also, I'd encourage any listeners to this podcast to tune in to yours and Ben's because it really is inspiring. So I mentioned in the preamble that you gave a TED Talk back in 2014 and that came quite early in your journey of writing your new book, The Leadership Map, which has been in the works for some time, I believe.
Mm.
And during that process of prepping for TED, you mentioned in one of the chapters of your book that it almost through a self-fulfilling prophecy led to your own moment of self-discovery. And I think your original title for TED involved self-discovery, but it caused you through seeing it through the lens of someone else, listening to your preparation, to elevate the importance of a phrase that you'd come up with in passing called the unbelievable dream, which really leapt out at me from your Leadership Map book. Can you tell the listeners and me, what was it like going through the process of preparing, rehearsing and presenting your TEDx talk to the TED panel? And then how did it contribute to the work of preparing your book?
Well, great question. Doing TEDx was something I hadn't thought about in my past, to be honest. And I was working with somebody I coach who had done a TEDx. And he said to me, oh, TEDx is coming around again in Woking, which is near where I live. Why don't you apply? And I said, well, what's the theme? Because you actually have to apply based on the theme they have and it has to fit the theme. And as you said, I put something forward. You know, it was a little bit like my unreasonable dream to do a TEDx. It was just something that I was telling myself a story that it, really that wasn't for me. And I had to change the story.
So a stretch target.
Yeah, well, it was. It was a complete stretch target. And it did, it changed me. As you know, we all have pivotal moments in our lives when we do something, we walk away and we go, wow, I just did that. And TEDx was a bit like that. I mean, it's quite frightening, to be honest, and I'll be honest and tell you that. I mean, the preparation was huge. You have to basically get on stage, talk for up to 16 minutes on an idea worth sharing, which is what TED say. It's got to be mainly stories, which is all the books I read on how to speak like TED tell you that. And you've got to have no notes pretty much and get up there and know it off by heart. So I had probably 60, 80, I don't know how many practices walking my dog in the woods and talking out loud as I walked along about what this would be and then refining it and presenting it to people who I trusted and say, what do you think? And I got so much great feedback back about it, which allowed me to tweak it and change it and grow something that in the end I could be proud of. But, you know, watching it back, you know what, now I look at it and I think, oh, I could have done that bit better. And, oh, I paused there too long. Oh, I paused there too short. You know, I'm always going to be a critic of my own TEDx. I know that.
Well, that's the consequence of perfectionism, I'm afraid. But, you know, it's something you should definitely look back on with pride. I think there would be many listeners that would, well, probably are followers of TED. But nice to know we've got one amongst us. And will you do another?
yeah, I mean, I, you know, it wouldn't be something that I would balk at now and say that's not for me, because I've done one, and hopefully I'd do a, you know, a better one, a better version. But that one, you know, I hope will stand the test of time, and it's got some good bits to it.
Oh, without a doubt. And I'd love to come on to talking about excerpts from the book. It covers so much ground for leaders that we couldn't possibly hope to cover it all in this half an hour episode. But I want to talk about the topics and the tenets that are aligned with what this podcast typically focuses on around level four, level five leadership and leading with authenticity. And you cover that really well in sort of chapters five, six, in the middle, the meat and bones in the middle of the book. So before we get into that, though, in a nod to the sort of thing that you guys do at the Gritty Leaders Club, we like our guests to share something that's captured their attention recently and got them thinking outside of the box. So that might be a new idea, a framework, a book, a talk, a video, or even a new asset class that you might be considering investing in, as they seem to be arriving at a rate of knots at the moment. So Ian, as of now, what's in your thought space?
Well, last Wednesday, Thursday, I took a senior leadership team off-site and we went to Snowdonia. And I was buzzing when I left, and I hope all the participants were, because the importance of getting people off-site into the countryside, getting them to relax together, putting them through a day's program that I ran on pretty much around the key messages of the TEDx around what's your purpose, what's your personal vision, how are you going to move from comfort into stretch, and getting them to think about those deep subjects, which people just don't. And, you know, twos and threes, going out for walks, coming back, reflecting, seeing how hard it is, but seeing how rewarding it can be once you start to make that journey. Sure. And then over dinner, getting them to do some vulnerability-based exercises, which got them to open up to each other. And you could just see them almost hour by hour coming closer together. And then on the final morning, I said to the CEO, we need to get them to let their hair down and get out and do some fun stuff as well. And we did all that over 2 days, and it was terrific. And it just reminded me why I do retreats, because they're so powerful for teams.
Well, first and foremost, it's nice to know that we can do them again.
That's right.
After them having been on hiatus for over a year. And secondly, yeah, it speaks to coaching for business leaders in general. How can you hope to work on the business if you're still sighted in the business? You've got to get everybody out of the business to be able to have that 1,000-foot view and, yeah, really do some deep diving work and bond them as a team, because I should imagine a number of them were very pleased to see each other's lower half for the first time in 12 months.
And funnily enough, I mean, it's the same with most teams, isn't there? There was a new person in the team who hadn't met the others. So, you know, how tall was this person going to be? Because you only see that top one third on Zoom.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's really interesting, and glad to hear that retreats are once again a thing we can do. So let's dive into the book. Now, what really intrigued me was that in addition to a few familiar case studies of well-known corporations and leaders, you've chosen to include some powerful real examples drawn from members of your own CEO coaching group and your business coaching clients. Now, I find that makes the book more tangible, more accessible. But what was your main motive for emphasizing these over the sort of tried and true kind of staple? And how keen were those leaders to be involved in the book?
Well, it was a worry, actually, because I thought I want to make this accessible. I mean, I've worked as a consultant in the corporate arena, you know, with BP and Castrol and Inland Revenue and British Army, all sorts of big organizations. And now for the last, you know, 10, 12 years, I've been working with SMEs. And I wanted to make it relevant to both. And I think there's so many parallels between what you do as an SME leader scaling a business and what the corporates are doing. There's a lot in common. And so I think we can learn. There's no reason why we can't learn from Steve Jobs in Apple or Jeff Bezos. We can also learn from people who have run Toyota and Lexus, and we can also learn from people who are doing a scale-up business. There's a lot in common, but also stories make books. You know, if I just filled this full of facts and figures and models, people would turn off pretty quickly, I think.
But the juxtaposition, as you mentioned there, of a Steve Jobs-esque kind of global example, right smack bang next to an SME based in Surrey or whatever, was really powerful, because it took it from kind of high level to eye level very, very accessibly, I thought. So nice touch.
Yeah, well, that was the purpose. In fact, when somebody said to me, are you going to write another book? And, you know, as soon as you put a great question in, and that's what one of the things leaders do, great leaders ask more questions than give answers, in my view. As soon as they put that question to me, I started thinking, God, if I was to write another book, what would it be about? And fairly quickly, it came to me bizarrely, which was, it will probably be around the leader. And I would love to make deep dive comparisons between the leaders we've all known and heard of throughout history and in recent times, and SME leaders that have been incredibly successful.
Oh, that would be good. Yeah, put it up there. I'll pre-order it.
Okay.
So I want to get into purposefulness because quite synonymously, as soon as you open the book, it hits you smack bang in the face in the first couple of chapters that it's really here to talk about leading with purpose, amongst many things. But the first opening chapters are about leading with purpose. And from your podcast, The Gritty Leaders Club, and from the Leadership Map book, it's apparent that you've got a personal admiration for the Japanese business culture and the practices of Asian corporations. And you mentioned Toyota to name but a few. Why is that?
Well, I did a lot of work for Toyota and Lexus. So there was a personal journey there where probably over a 10-year period where I worked quite alongside the CEO of Toyota Lexus GB. And then I worked for the European director and did a lot of work for Lexus, a slightly different arm of Toyota. So I got to look at how they worked internally and I really admired the way they kind of had real discipline about what they do, real great models. But they thought a lot. You know, I think one of the things about the Asian culture is they probably get into action a bit later. They want to consider things. They used to say in Toyota, we take a long time to consider what to do, but when we do it, we act really quickly and decisively because they've taken that time. So I kind of built up an admiration for that way of working. And of course, you can't argue with, you know, how Toyota and Lexus have done over the years, incredible car companies, although they're being really challenged now, of course, with Tesla, amongst others, coming along. So I love that. And then, of course, I started reading a bit more widely about the Japanese culture. I'll be honest now, I've never been to Japan. It's on my bucket list. I must get out there. Closest I got was Hong Kong, where I used to work for a while, 3 years. But then I started admiring just other things about Japan. I first read The Blue Zones, which is a great book for people who are interested in that, about
life expectancy, right?
Yeah, the people in the world who live the longest. And Okinawa is where was one of the blue zones where people live the longest. And actually, that's where I first came across the Ikigai model, which I put in the book. And there's various books about Ikigai and about this, you know, the joy of enjoying what you do, getting up in the morning, jumping out of bed. And one of the things I started thinking about when I was coaching CEOs years ago, and I used to say to people, one of the questions I used to ask was, what does perfect look like for you? And that would freak them out a little bit. They'd say, what do you mean, what does perfect look
like? Great question.
Okay, well, when you get up in the morning and you go to work, you know, what would perfect be? And they'd start describing after a while, once they got over my question, as in what would perfect look like? What kind of job would they have? What kind of organization would they run? What kind of family life would they have? What kind of health and well-being would they have? And I'd say, so what's stopping you getting all that? And we'd start working through that. And at the heart of all that is a real drive for purpose, living my purpose. What is your purpose? And I'd try and anchor the people I coach in that place. And I think businesses, you know, the best businesses are also anchored there.
I completely agree. And, you know, the Japanese Ikigai concept is so powerful in its own right. And it is, as you say, there are many books about it, but I still don't think it's completely permeated the sort of public consciousness of leadership. So yeah, as I mentioned, purpose was really coming across strongly in the first few chapters of your book. And I guess to quote a mutual friend, Mr. Johnson, you know, you start with the end in mind.
Yeah.
But what does Ikigai represent to you? And how do you hope that the readers of the Leadership Map will apply it?
Well, I think the model is so simple. You know, it starts off with what you love. And I think people need to, again, going back to what you do, what perfect looks like, you've got to love your job. If you don't, go and find one you love. You know, life's too short. And with leaders, that's, you know, I've coached people out of businesses where the business have paid me to coach them, because it's not about the business, it's about the individual. You've got to love what you do. Get up in the morning and love what you do. And no one's going to book me now if they hear this, are they? So you've got to love what you do. Then, as Ikigai said, you know, the world has got to need it. Then you've got to be good at it. And then you need to be paid for it. So it's such a simple model, Ikigai. And at the heart of that is then this real purpose. I use it as a way to get into that subject. What I say to people, and I ran another workshop last week on purpose, was, do you know, there's no easy way into this. You might just wake up one morning and go, I got it. I know what it is. It's this. Other ways are using a model such as this and saying, this might help us get into that. But at the end of the day, when you know what your purpose is, you'll wake up and go, I've got it. It's there. When it's a bit ambiguous and there's lacks clarity and you're not really sure, then you haven't got to it yet. Yeah. And these are messy. You know, I always say getting your purpose, finding out your vision, personally or professionally, is messy stuff. It takes a while.
I came to leadership through the sales and marketing route through a business. And very early in my sales career, I attended a seminar delivered by John Fenton, a name that you might remember. Fantastic, sort of the Zig Ziglar era, sort of Britain's version of, sorry, John. And he really hit me square between the eyes with the concept that you can't sell what you don't love. You know, that stayed with me all the way through my CEOship, that frankly, if I don't believe in it, I can't expect my people to follow me and believe in it. And I think that's what an ikigai gives you, even if it comes to you through an epiphany or through a consciously crafted kind of discovery process. If you don't have it, then you lack something in your authenticity. And that brings me on to the passion, because you mentioned part of that Venn diagram of ikigai is about having a passion.
Mm.
How strongly does that play into ikigai for you? And typically, how important is it to be passionate about purpose?
Oh, completely. Again, I have to be passionate about doing what I do. I think we get mixed up in leadership between inspiration and passion. You know, people look at people and go, oh, he's inspirational. I couldn't be inspirational. Nonsense. You know, I say to leaders, you know, charisma, inspiration can confuse us all. You know, people will say, oh, I'm not sure I've got charisma. I'm not sure I'm inspiring enough. I'd say, do you believe in what this business you serve, you run, does? Absolutely. Can you be passionate about it? Absolutely. Then you're going to inspire people, you know, and whether they call you charismatic or not does not matter. You know, all the work Jim Collins has done about level five leaders, which you mentioned earlier, it's not about being charismatic. It's about this humility and unwavering will to do good, to lead your business, to lead people.
100%. And I think actually you talk about the dichotomy between that veneer versus authenticity in the message. And yeah, that came across to me very loudly and very clearly. And I would say that a number of the leaders that have really inspired me over the years have sort of pursued inspiration through perspiration rather than through persuasion and charisma.
Yeah.
So there's a soundbite. But yeah, I personally feel that purpose is really important. I'm pleased to hear that it's equally ranked in ikigai generally. So one great quote that I picked up from the leadership map of yours is, vision is purpose with a timeline, which I thought that was excellent. How did you come to that realization? And over what sort of period or horizon is it typically useful for leaders to set their timeline in order for it to be both relevant but stretching?
Well, I steal with pride when I read books. And there's a book by a guy called Cameron Herold called Vivid Vision. And he sets out very clearly, he's a great speaker as well. And I've seen him on stage speaking on YouTube to Vistage in the US. He's very, very clear on this. He said a vision should be a vivid vision, something that's written down in many pages that says, what's our business going to look like? And he says very clearly, in 3 years' time. And he says any longer than that becomes too woolly. Any shorter than that is a plan to get there. So he's very clear. And do you know what? When I read that, I thought, I've been looking for this. I've been looking for something that pins it down. And he's very persuasive. And so I've gone with 3 years. I think it's a very useful timeline to go with, and a vivid vision. And basically what your vision's doing, it's realizing your purpose to some extent. It's taking your purpose. How are we going to realize this? How are we going to move it forward? And so you're then becoming much more tangible over a three-year period, and then you can fill in the steps to get there.
And it's a deliverable time frame as well, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, we've just seen it with COVID-19. There are going to be roadblocks and obstacles along the way that you have to adapt your strategy, your plan, and your budget typically. But 3 years, you know, you can see that. That's tangible. Mm. You can reach out and touch it almost, lasso it and bring it closer.
Completely. And of course, even with 3 years, you know, we've seen, as you said, things speed up dramatically over COVID, over the pandemic. And so you sit down there, you create a three-year vision. Do you know what? 6 months, 9 months, 12 months later, you're looking at it and saying, you know, we're going to have to adjust this slightly. Don't be afraid to adjust anything in business. You know, these things, I think, we go back in business 10, 20 years ago. It was about put something in stone and then work towards it over the next, 10 years. That's gone, in my view. You know, this is a far quicker environment we're living in now.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I've touched on it in other episodes about how fast business is iterating now and all of these new paradigms, particularly in something like the Internet of Value, where, you know, every day there is a new layer or a new protocol. It is incredible. And yes, that trickles down into every organization, that there is an expectation of things iterating at speed. And that brings me on to, I guess, chapter 5 of your book, where we're challenging the status quo. And that is where you encourage leaders to really open up their organizations to challenge from within, which isn't easy to do, and to go through an iterative process of try, fail, and learn, which I guess is to some extent at the heart of your unreasonable dream principle. Mm. So you suggest that in doing that, leaders, you know, push for omnidirectional stretch and change and making that endemic in their company, and that they coach their team to step outside of their comfort zone, which again isn't easy. But what is the net likely gain typically going to be from doing that?
Probably the most important thing a leader can do, and certainly the most fulfilling, is to develop another leader. And the way you develop somebody is by giving them the safety and the comfort that they're going to be okay if they don't do this brilliantly. You've obviously got to coach them and make sure they know what they're doing as best you can. And preparation, all those things are really important. But at the end of the day, people can fail. They can fall over. They might not be perfect. So you need to build this safety around them. And then you need to encourage them to do something where there's an unknown outcome. Now, when you put somebody in a new pitch, for example, and you say, you're going to lead this pitch, you don't really know whether they're going to do it brilliantly. They're certainly probably not the way you'd do it. So there's an unknown outcome. And that's the, as Brené Brown said, you know, vulnerability is being challenged to do something when the outcome's unknown. And that's what we have to do as people. And we have to get our people to do it. Because as soon as you do that, a bit like me doing my TEDx, you know, I walked up to that stage and thought, give me Wembley. You know, I was feeling in that moment. And that's because I'd stretched myself. And I said on the stage, you know, I am in my stretch zone. And I absolutely was. And I think when we encourage people to go there, and I had some feedback recently from a program I was running where the CEO said to me, one of his leaders had come up to him and said, he had realized that I'm doing a 2-year program for this company. He said he had realized that before this program, he had been sitting in his comfort zone for 10 years. It was a big realization to him. And I thought,
so easily done
completely. But I think there's so much we gain from life. You know, when you go to stretch, you get energy, you know, you get excitement, you get engagement, you get learning, you get growth, you get all those things when you go into stretch. Avoid going into stress, because that's what it says on the tin, but encourage people to go to stretch, because that's where they can create the most of themselves on this planet.
So it really does speak to that process of self-discovery. And as you say, it's probably one of the most vital obligations that we as leaders have,
yeah,
is to help build up our team and create leaders of the future. I mean, a little axiom that I live by is true leaders build new leaders. Mm. And, you know, you can't do better than that as a leader, to not least for your own succession planning.
Yeah, but couldn't agree more.
And delegation, two clear reasons to do so.
You can't grow a business without growing your people.
Very well said, sir.
Yeah, and that's what this is all about.
So the try, fail and learn iteration, which, you know, I have heard probably 10 years ago coming through publications like Wired, aimed at the sort of tech space, and particularly those global tech corporates kind of live by that iterative try, fail and learn approach. But in your experience, the learning side, how easy is it to capture and how can it be applied?
Well, I think one of the things leaders need to do is reflect on how they're performing, be very self-aware, be emotionally intelligent. That's what the great leaders are. And so they look at something they've done and they say, well, look, where did it go well? Where didn't it go well? You know, we have a great thing in Vistage, don't we, called WWWEBI, where we look at what's gone well, even better if, and, you know, and that kind of goes into your bones after a while. And you think, okay, well, if I showed up and did something, let's have a look. How did I think I did? You can get feedback from others. You can get feedback from yourself. You know, when you read books like Legacy about the All Blacks and you hear, you know, mm-hmm. the best performing team ever, if you look at any sport really in their ratio of wins to losses, they come off the pitch and they've won 42-10. I think the first chapter is about when they beat Wales and they go back to the changing room and they reflect on what they could have done better. And I think one of the things as leaders we need to encourage more of, and you see it in even, you know, really well performing organizations where they come off their pitch, which might be a pitch or it might be a meeting, could be anything, and they go on to the next thing. They don't sit down enough, quickly enough, and say, right, what went well? Because often, if we're going to do that at all in businesses, often we go, how can we improve something? No, let's praise ourselves also for what went really well. I think that's so important. And there's a couple of models I've put in the book as well. One is PDCA, Plan, Do, Check, Act, which, again, a lot of people be familiar with if they're in engineering or lean manufacturing, or Toyota use it all the time, even in sales and marketing. And that really is having a process, a system, the discipline to look at really what's gone well, what do we need to systematize back in the business, what didn't go so well, etc. So there's a few tools around you can use, but it's fundamental, I think, to growing.
So learning through that post-match analysis approach.
Absolutely.
And I've noticed in the leadership map that it's peppered with examples of professional sportsmen and coaches and teams, and you draw some very accessible analogies between that and business leadership.
Mm-hmm.
What, in your mind, are the key similarities there?
Well, I think the wonderful thing about sport is when it goes well and when it goes badly, it's accelerated and there's usually a number on it. So you go and do a pitch and you lose it, you actually win it or lose it. In sport, it's 3-1. It's, you know, 15 love. It's very quick and tangible to give you feedback. And in sport, it's all videoed. So you can look back on it and go, oh, that backhand wasn't so good, or that cross was awful. And so I think what we can learn from sport is so many things. I mean, you can tell I love sport by reading the book. But
oh, yes.
Another key thing, of course, is the coach or the leader makes the difference, sets the tone, is the role model. And if you look at people like Jurgen Klopp or Pep Guardiola, or you look at Eddie Jones, you know, you look at all these different people, very different personalities. And that's the other thing about leadership. Don't try and copy anyone else. Just figure out what your own style is, what your own way of doing things is. But learn a few tips and techniques from others. So I do love sport. I always read sports books. There's so many great ones out there. And I'm always discovering new ones. You know, the Michael Johnson on Netflix was an incredible series about a person, but how he was coached to bring the best out of him. So I think, you know, leaders who are great coaches become really good leaders. So I could go on forever on sports and leadership, but there are huge similarities, I think.
In the mix of how they analyse the qualitative as well as the quantitative, you mentioned the scoring there, clear kind of binary, you've either won or you've lost. But the way that you went about winning or losing, the qualities that you exhibited are where the nuances of a coach, I think, come into play.
Completely. And I think, you know, the other thing we see, and I use analogies all the time for this, we spend as leaders and as businesses too much time or too much percentage on the pitch and not enough time in the preparation. Now, you look at a rugby team, a football team, a basketball team. What's the percentage of preparation, of coaching, of skill building, of praising before you get on the pitch? It's huge. But in business, we're on the pitch most of our time, and we're not spending enough time. Like the retreat I talked about earlier. The retreat is your prep. It's building you up to go back on the pitch.
It's the training field.
It's the training field. And we're not in the training field enough in business.
Well said. And of course, in order to cement any improvements, often the coach has to take the members of the team through a process of change. And you cover change really well in the leadership map. In fact, I was particularly struck by your three cog model, the change flywheel, which shows that interrelation of planning, engaging and embedding change. Can you talk the listeners through how this fits with some more well-established, widely used concepts we might be familiar with, such as Cotter's 8-step change plan?
Well, I used to use Cotter. I mean, I studied Cotter when I did my MBA at Henley, and I love Cotter, and I used Cotter forever, and I still love Cotter. You know, there's no way I'm dissing Cotter. And in fact, one of the first edits of this book just had the Cotter 8 steps in, and you know, I was going to go with that. And suddenly I had one of those aha moments when I was editing it for about the 567th time, where I remembered the Salomé wheel, the learning wheel, and I suddenly thought, that's the piece that there's not enough of in Cotter. And so I went back to looking at that wheel, the Salomé change wheel, which is basically saying, if you want people to change, and the Cotter's 8 steps is basically about, you've got to get people to change. You know, the systems don't change without the people. So if you want people to change, you've got to give them enough context around what you're talking about. Then you've got to ask the right questions, and then they will draw a conclusion. If those 2 steps are done well, the conclusion they draw will be the same as yours. And where we go wrong in organizations is we sit down as a leadership team for months or years, and we come to a conclusion, and then we tell everyone what our conclusion is and wonder why they don't buy in. So for me, it's hugely powerful to bring this very simple learning model and put it in here. So, you know, it's the people engagement part of those 3 cogs, and the other 2 are basically Cotter's 8 steps put into 6.
Got it. I mean, that's very respectful of the team. And that's very much why this is more fit for the modern age, in my opinion, because, you know, good level 5 leaders have an appreciation for the intelligence of their team and for the fact that if presented with a logical argument, a reasoned, you know, presentation and the facts, as you say, the team will draw sensible conclusions that often match the leaders. Mm-hmm. And change in older models, not necessarily Cotter, but I mean, I'm thinking maybe Lewin, they work on the basis that change is forced on people rather than people coming to the consideration or the same conclusion. So, yeah, I really liked how that spoke to me, and the interrelation is very new. So I hope that people pick up on that and apply it in their own businesses. So we get to step eight of COTTA, or step eight of the change flywheel, and we're embedding those changes into the corporate culture. Now, clearly that's vital for both adoption and efficacy of those changes, but it's not always easy to update the software, if you will, with the change and get it truly reflecting in the corporate culture. So do you have any tips or any case studies that you've worked on where it makes it possible to evolve the culture of a business and ensure that there are buy-ins to those updates as the culture evolves?
Yeah, I think it's interesting you mentioned Lewin, and I think where we go wrong is an old style of leadership where we genuinely believe that, you know, okay, we've got this big change program coming along, so we're going to unfreeze what we've got, and then we're going to get everyone involved in the change program, then we're going to refreeze it. And all you do is you stop people changing. You just say, yeah, I'm going to do it to you. They don't buy in, and then they wonder why it's not working so well. And then the next, you know, CEO leadership team come along and they'll try something new. And that actually changes the culture, or keeps the culture in the wrong place. Yeah, the only thing that works is constant change and creating a business where we know that if we create enough safety and we encourage people to take the managed risk, and we coach them and we develop them and we train them and we create a learning culture, then people will be up for moving out of their comfort zone into their stretch zone. We'll get a culture that really is a true learning culture, and we'll grow people and we'll grow everything and we'll grow the business. And that's the only way to be, really. So I think
it's a continuous fluidity, isn't it? I mean, and we have to roll with those punches as leaders and inject those updates as we go.
Exactly. You're quite right.
So I think it's probably very deliberate on your part then that the very next chapter after the challenging of the status quo is about how to build your dream team. And you evoke building that dream team around values. We've effectively learned how to apply change and to update the corporate culture. But you then bravely assert that a foundation of trust can be built through mutual vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And you give an example of the I am poem exercise that you've had to undergo excruciatingly, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah.
You give a number of other sort of leveler exercises, which are really powerful. That probably makes uncomfortable reading for some autocratic leaders. But can you expand on why it's important to do it?
Yeah, well, I guess my influences there have been going through it myself with some amazing facilitators in the Vistage community, and reading people like Len Scioni and Brené Brown, who talk extensively about the power of vulnerability. But I think with vulnerability, you've got to experience it yourself to get it. And to me, you know, the chair training I did, Vistage chair training 9 years ago, was a pivotal moment for me. And then running those exercises with groups and seeing in a safe environment, again, how becoming vulnerable, which people are not used to in the main, especially on leadership mm-hmm. teams, what they find is how powerful that is by doing it. So you show something about yourself. And then one of your colleagues comes up to office and says, that's amazing. I didn't know you did that. That's, you know, that's, and you got through it. And that's, God, that's so brave of you. That's incredible. And then, do you know what? You've grown a couple of degrees closer to that person, and you've got their back a bit more, and the team starts to come together a bit more. The key thing about vulnerability is you'll never create a team based on vulnerability-based trust without the leader going first. And
yeah,
you can't have a leader sitting there going, do you know what? My guys just don't tell me. They're not honest enough. They don't bring the real issues to the table. And then you find out that he or she's not doing that either. Well, of course, it's not going to work. You know, vulnerability leads to what Len Scioni would say was conflict. And I would say is a, you know, a deep, meaningful discussion on a leadership team. What you want when you meet is to talk about the things that really matter for a leadership team. You know, a great question to start a leadership meeting in a team is, what's the most important thing we should discuss today? And get everyone to input what they think the most important thing for the business they should discuss today. And that's what too many teams prior to what I'm doing at the moment, I found didn't do. They went to the agenda, they went to the plan, they skirted around the issues, they had artificial harmony. And then that could lead to personal digs. What they didn't know each other enough, have enough vulnerability, have enough openness, have enough trust to go, this is the issue. I'm not very good at this, or this bit's going wrong in our business and we need to fix it now. And then, okay, let's look at it. Let's support each other. Let's get in there. Let's challenge each other. Let's get to the heart of this. Let's fix it and let's move on. But unless we're doing that, we're not addressing the key things in our businesses today. And that all starts with being vulnerable and open.
and thereby knowing each other and being able to be authentic with each other. And I think you present very clearly in the book how it's important that the leader doesn't just lead with a poker face. You know, this isn't an autocracy, that actually leading with authenticity and not that veneer of excellence, as you put it, that's very pertinent actually to the expectations of today's new workforce. You know, those from the millennial and the Gen Z generations that are entering the workforce today. Have you got any examples that you've worked on where that trust has come through demonstrating authenticity rather than a veneer?
Well, I guess every time I see a group grow and they start to bond and they start to create something they hadn't created before, I'm seeing an example of it.
It's inherent in the Vistage model, well, isn't it, really? Let's be honest.
When COVID hit and we were in that first weekend post Boris's announcement, a company I work with very closely and have done for about 10 years, the CEO created a video to the 900 staff he was just about to furlough.
Wow.
And he stood in front of his values and he said, this is what we're going to do. And this is how we're going to come through it. And this is the problems we've got. And he spoke for about 20 minutes from the heart. And he referenced a couple of the values, and that's how they were leading their decisions through living these values. And do you know what? They've come out the other end after a year and 3-4 months, and they've had a couple of times when they've gone back to work as an organization. The only people he kept fully on the payroll who all had pay cuts were the management team.
Yeah.
And they've all come back, and they've had the best 2 months since they've come back, and 1 month actually, isn't it, in their history. And everyone's come back with huge energy, huge productivity, huge commitment. Why? Because he kept them there. He kept talking to them. He kept doing these videos. He kept being honest. He kept being authentic. And he's a real inspiration to me, actually, to watch this guy lead his business.
Yeah, he deserves a year of success ahead with that loyalty of his staff. That's no mean feat to keep in contact during that prolonged period of furlough. Mm. So you promote also in the book the need for intellectual humility, which seems to go further than the traditional kind of open-mindedness. I'm sure, like me, listeners would love to hear more on your definition of intellectual humility.
Well, I think it's I think I first read about, you know, humility being an important trait of a leader in Jim Collins's, you know, Level 5 Leadership. And I remember when I first studied leadership and you ask people, you know, which of the leaders you admire, and you start seeing people who are extroverts, who are probably slightly egocentric. And actually, when it comes down to it, and we look at leaders that, you know, go from good to great, we discover that it is about this humility, this service. You know, you have to be in service of something. That's what leadership is. That's what organizations are. Go from, you know, ego-driven to delivering something of value. I saw Jim Collins speak once, and he said he had been with Peter Drucker.
Gosh, that's opposing forces.
Yeah. And he came out at the end of the day, and Jim Collins was getting into his car. He said this from a stage. I was very lucky to hear him. And he says, getting into the car. And Peter Drucker said, one more thought for you, Jim. And that is, most leaders try to be successful. Don't try to be successful. Be useful.
Nice.
And I thought that was about humility. That was about understanding that we're doing this for somebody else. We're not doing it for ourselves. Our businesses are created to give value to customers, to clients. They're not for ourselves. They're to build a legacy here where we'll move on and somebody else will step in. And we need to take people on that journey. We need to keep the journey going for as long as we can for others to take over and continue. So I think this humility thing really rings true for me. The leaders I trust most, the leaders who are most vulnerable, who are humble, who have a certain humility about the way they go along, who are honest about things, they're the ones that get people following them. They're the ones, you know, definition of leadership is, have you got any followers? You know, they're the ones in today's world with Gen Z and millennials, they're the ones people want to follow and walk behind.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, the servant leader concept is no longer a concept. It is leadership.
Yeah.
And you frequently reference Simon Sinek's Leaders Eat Last, which is an inspiration along that vein. Another enlightening visual in the leadership map is your 6 concentric ringed team excellence model, which goes through the journey of setting the purpose, establishing safety, trust, creating challenge, securing commitment, and then consequently the team outcomes. safety stood out to me in this as being paramount, but is often overlooked. Mm. And it's back to that vulnerability piece again. But why do you think it's so often overlooked?
I'm not sure it's talked about very much. You mentioned Selleck. That's where I first started to think about safety. And then I sort of reflected and saw, well, where have I seen this? Where have I seen leaders actually use that word and say, because you can come into a room and go, well, this is something I screwed up on last week. So let's go around the room and see who else has screwed up last week. You know, you can do it on an artificial level, but you've got to build safety over time. You've got to praise people. You've got to show them you care. You've got to build this support network. You've got to demonstrate that when things go wrong, you put your arm around them and say, look, that's okay. And so you build safety over time. And when you've built a real sense of safety and you've got a purpose at the beginning of the heart of your team and something that pulls them together and says, this is our purpose. So this is our vision. This is our values. This is why we're together as a team. Then you build this safety net and then you'll start to get vulnerability. It's an order about this. You know, then when the vulnerability starts to flow, then they'll put the real issues on the table. Then they'll say they didn't do something so well, or I will help you out because I trust you and I've seen you're vulnerable and I will help you out because you're in my leadership team. You know, from that, we're going to get the commitment, we're going to get the accountability, and we're going to get the team results. So it's a mixture. Again, I like mixing models, as you know. So Lencioni inspired me so much with his 5 dysfunctions of a team. And I've mixed in a little bit of Simon Sinek there and a little bit of perhaps Ian Wendell Purpose there and created a model of team excellence, which I think covers more bases than any one of those on their own.
It certainly does. And you mentioned the 4 fears that leaders should be aware that their colleagues may have, you know, the fear of getting it wrong, losing, rejection, and criticism. And a number of leaders might think that safety can just simply be established and those 4 fears mitigated by achieving a sort of surface level consensus of shared purpose. Well, you know, we're all here to achieve the same thing. So, you know, let's know that we're in a safe space. That's not often enough. You actually highlight the need in the book for belonging and caring and support and encouragement. That's actually probably the first time in print I've seen that used and dived into so deeply, also in such a sort of linear chronological way of going from establishing purpose to achieving outcomes and dealing with safety as sort of step 2. Did you have to call on certain reserves, or was it front and center in your mind regarding that, you know, the belonging, the caring, the support and encouragement? Because to put names on those was quite groundbreaking in itself.
To be honest, you know, some of these things I have seen, I have, you know, experienced, therefore I write them down, I put them together, I build a model. And others I've, you know, can I say I've taken those 4 words from somebody? Somebody will probably, you know, send me an email and say, you got that from so-and-so. But when you read as much as I do and take as much as I do and experience as much as I do, I'm not quite sure where the 4 words came from. But I think, you know, you started with fear. And there's a great book I'm reading at the moment from Dr. Pippa Grange called Fearless Rather Than Fearless.
Yeah.
And it talks about the fact we're all driven by fear. And I think that's one of the, again, the ahas I've had more recently, looking at, you know, how we, I'd said, you know, I had a fear of doing a TED talk, which was, you know, a story I made up in my mind because, you know, I wasn't the person who got on stage at school. I wasn't the extrovert who stood up in meetings and talked. So who was I to get on a TEDx stage and do a TEDx? So sometimes we have to overcome our fears, understand which stories are behind those fears and recreate those stories, see them, face them, and then change them. So to me, that's a very powerful thing when you're dealing with leaders. What stories are they telling themselves? And how can they change those to the right stories to become a better leader? But in terms of those 4 words, yeah, where do they come from? I think they came from my head at some point and I joined them together.
Hey, look, there's an element of osmosis in all of this. And like you say, the greater the body of reading that you do, the greater likelihood that it's permeated somewhere. But we're all adding to the combined evolving knowledge of the human race. So
exactly.
You know, yeah. And you mentioned about leaders there and how you have to bring those fears and those stories front and center, but also encourage them to do the same with their team and waterfall that down. Ian, I mean, we've covered a lot of ground. And as I said at the beginning of this episode, you know, your book, The Leadership Map, does cover so much great content that leaders can apply that it would be difficult to squeeze all that into this half an hour, 45 minute period. So thank you very much. I'm sure our listeners will be very keen to dive into your book and also to tune into the Gritty Leaders podcast. I'll make sure that there are links in the show notes, as well as to the Vivid Vision by Cameron Herold and Dr. Pippa Grainger's Fearless books that you've tipped us there, because I'll make sure that they're accessible too.
Great.
How do readers and listeners get in touch with Ian Windle should they want to reach out for speaking and coaching, etc.?
The simplest way is to drop me an email at ian@ianwindle.com.
Well, there you go.
Simple.
Well, before we end, I do this with every guest. Sorry to put you on the spot, but I'm interested to hear what your vision of the medium-term horizon of our future looks like in your mind's eye. We like to leave our listeners with thoughts from our guests on their hopes for the world of tomorrow. So if you just jump in your time machine, fast forward with me, near-term, 10-year horizon, what do you expect the big paradigm shifts in the business world to have been? And what do you think the coaching needs of leaders might be as a result of those changes?
Great question. I love it to end on. I hope that we'll be running businesses that are based around the three Ps of people, planet, and profits. And I hope we move from a shareholder model to a stakeholder model. I've been reading a bit on big corporations recently and had a few companies that are going down that path, whether it be to actually become B Corps, but to actually engage in this future where we do look at other things other than profits and what we do with those profits. I hope we'll be, you know, much more team-based and understanding and, you know, proper, you know, learning organizations where everyone is looked at in terms of what Dan Pink said, which was mastery, autonomy, and purpose. So are we developing the mastery of our people? And I hope we become more transparent as organizations. I've got a business now who have taken on board this concept from another book called The Great Game of Business and are revealing all their financials to every person in the business and getting them to start to own KPIs from the bottom to the top. And the engagement in that business has been phenomenal. And so I hope we're more transparent. I hope we're based around people, planet, and profits. And I hope we're much more team-based in the future.
Well, you know, that speaks very heavily to the underlying theme and tone of this podcast series. So thank you very much for bringing it home for me. A couple of recommended readings: Conscious Business by Fred Kaufman from back in the 90s. I think that started us all on that journey, pre the days of ESG. And if you're a regular FT reader, Moral Money is a fantastic column, which is doing just that, talking about actually how we can be responsibly investing and as business leaders, responsibly operating. So, yeah, thanks, Ian, very much for rounding that off for us and for giving up so much of your time this evening. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I look forward to your next TED Talk, your next book, and more immediately, the next edition of the Gritty Leaders podcast. So thank you. Speak to you very soon.
Thanks very much, Gareth. Been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed our discussion with Ian Windle as much as I enjoyed speaking with him. If you'd like to be kept up to date automatically with our future episodes, please remember to click the subscribe button in your preferred podcast app. In our next episode, I'll be speaking with social impact consultant and leadership coach Amina Ahmed about lifelong learning, faith, focus, and Buddhism. If you'd like to suggest a guest for a future episode, please reach out on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'm at GPG Hawkins. Or you can email us on podcast@ceoptimist.com. Until then, remember to live with intention, make choices based on your values, and not let the choices of other people define you.